This is the second day of this October 2011 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from our text of yesterday. Zen Dawn is the name of the book, and this is a collection of early Zen texts from the Dunhuang Caves, the very earliest Zen texts. I guess that's the point behind the title Zen Dawn, at the very origin of our school of Zen, or Chan, Chinese, to use the Chinese word. Buddhism itself, by the time these masters, and the lives of these masters, Buddhism had already been in China for some 450 years. So Zen was kind of a latecomer to the great long tradition of Buddhism. We left off yesterday reading from what is alleged to be the predecessor of Bodhidharma, Gunabhadra. You know, he's not in our ancestral line. His name does not appear before Bodhidharma. The name before Bodhidharma is Prajnatara, and the texts say that this was Bodhidharma's teacher, Prajnatara, and he's the one who told Bodhidharma to leave India and go to China. But here we have this Gunabhadra, so we'll keep reading from the story of this guy. Just now I spoke of pacifying mind. In brief, there are four kinds of mentality. First, the mentality that turns away from truth. This is the mentality of those who go through life as ordinary people. Second, the mentality that turns toward truth. This means loathing birth and death, and so seeking nirvana and going toward stillness. It is called the Shravaka mentality. Let me just stop and comment on these first two. The mentality that turns away from truth. There's another text, I think a Chinese text, Chinese Zen text, that refers to something like, for incalculable eons we have been turning away from the light and instead turning toward the dark, the falseness. Greed, anger, and delusion. So this, as he says, this is the mentality of those who go through life as ordinary people with no interest in seeing through this world of life and death, suffering. That would be about 99% of the world. And then the second one, the mentality that turns toward truth, which he equates with a Shravaka. Shravaka is most of you know of the six realms of unenlightened existence. And then the next, the four of enlightened existence, this is the first of the four, the Shravaka. I've had to look this up about 50 times to remind myself what Shravaka means. And this morning as well, I did that. Basically, it means a seeker. Literally, it means one who hears. But a seeker. So this is already a big leap in evolution. Roshi Kaplow's, one of his books, Zen, Merging of East and West, he dedicates, in the dedication, he says, dedicated not to those who seek, but those who find. apparently in Roshi Kaplow's time, maybe in the 60s, it was kind of a pat on the back. You give yourself a pat on the back if you label yourself as a seeker. I'm a seeker. Well, it's better than turning away from the truth. But the third one is the finder. Third, the mind that enters truth. Though you cut off barriers to the path and reveal inner truth, subject and object are not yet nullified. This is the bodhisattva mentality. So it's clearly having reached some state of awakening, but not the deepest awakening. And fourth, the mind of truth. So the one who turns away from the truth, the one who turns toward truth, the one who enters truth, and now the mind of truth itself. Not mind outside truth, not truth outside mind. Truth is mind. Mind is able to be everywhere equal, so it is called truth. Truth's awareness can illuminate everything, so it is called mind. Mind and truth are everywhere equal, so it is called Buddha mind, the mind of enlightenment. Most people who use this word truth, at least in the spiritual sense, they have no idea what an abstraction it is. Truth. Where is it? Up in north or the west or east? Or where is this thing called truth? There is no such thing as an abstraction hanging somewhere out there that we need to get to. This is truth, reality. Just this. And it cannot be separated from mind. Nothing can be separated from mind. To talk about truth as something out there suggests that it's apart from mind. This is the genius of Zen, I believe, is just recognizing how we, in using words, once we use the word of anything, we miss it. Those who understand reality do not see any difference between birth and death and nirvana or ordinary and holy. Objects and knowledge are not two. Inner truth and phenomena are fused. Real and conventional are viewed as equal. Defilement and purity are one suchness. Buddhas and sentient beings are fundamentally equal and at one. Sentient beings is the standard designation in Zen texts of the so-called unenlightened, and Buddhas means the enlightened. So just to plug in those substitutes, the enlightened and the unenlightened are fundamentally equal and at one. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. This very body, the body of Buddha. This is the bedrock of faith in the Zen school, and actually in all of all of Buddhism. This was the Buddha's enlightenment, realizing that his nature was no other than the nature of all beings. This enlightened nature is what we are all equally endowed with. There is no such thing as an enlightened one apart from us. Yeah, we hear this, yeah, blah, 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 blah. It's a very different thing to confirm it through your own experience rather than just having faith in it. Guna Bahadra continues, "The great path is fundamentally omnipresent, perfectly pure, and basically existent. It is not attained from causes." In other words, it's beyond cause and effect, before and after. "It is like the sun hidden behind floating clouds. When the clouds are gone, the sun appears by itself." So that's our mind, mind with a capital M. That's our true nature. The sun behind floating clouds, or the blue sky. It may be obscured by even dark, thick clouds, but behind it, it's always there. It's not something we have to get to that at one time doesn't exist and then later does exist. It's there, it's here, always. This bright blue sky, it's just covered by clouds. "What's the use of any more learning or views? Why become involved in written or spoken words and come back again to the path of birth and death?" This pairing of birth and death is one that I think many of us may find a little odd, because it's contrary to our whole Western cultural ethos. Death, sure, who wants to have anything to do with death? But birth and death is the pairing that we see all through Buddhist texts, including Zen texts. But just a moment of thought reveals that they are inseparable. That is, if you have any belief in rebirth. After death, rebirth. It's the round of existence, the whole round of time, change, aging, dying, rebirth. Rebirth means that there will be aging and dying. Aging and dying are embedded in birth. To put it another way, as soon as we're born, we begin dying. I remember the first time I was reading the biography of the great Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi, for those of you who are not familiar with him, was a young man who lived in India in the maybe in the 1920s, when he was 16 years old, he had a spontaneous profound enlightenment experience. And he was drawn to a hill, a nearby hill, and he went up to the top of the hill. It's kind of a small mountain. And he had an ashram built there, and he never came down until he died up there. It's a really remarkable person. He once said, I think someone suggested that they celebrate someone's birthday, or maybe they just said happy birthday. And he said, with serene detachment, he said, you know, you celebrate birthdays, but really it should be an occasion of mourning. Remember when I read that, I thought, oh, give me a break. But there is, you know, as I've aged, I've come to take a different perspective on it. But of course, we will continue to celebrate birthdays at the Zen Center. And not put on a long face as we're cutting up that cake. So just to repeat that last sentence, why become involved in written or spoken words and come back again to the path of birth and death? Those who take verbal explanations and literary accounts as the way covet fame and profit. They ruin themselves and ruin others. It is like polishing a mirror. When the dust on the surface has been totally removed, the mirror of itself is bright and clear. This sentence, those who take verbal explanations and literary accounts as the way, covet fame and profit. I'm not sure what he means there, but it does bring to mind this statement somewhere. I don't know what, all is vanity. Goes on, all things are uncompounded. The Lankavatara Sutra says, the Buddha is not Buddha, nor does he save sentient beings. Sentient beings impose distinctions and think that Buddha saves sentient beings. They do not realize this mind, and they have no stability. This statement, the Buddha is not Buddha, and the following one, nor does he save sentient beings, is really an expression of the fundamental truth of emptiness or shunyata. And it's the hardest, this teaching of emptiness is the most difficult to grasp. In fact, it can't really be grasped except through awakening. But all, to put it more broadly, every single thing, ultimately, is no thing. Things give the appearance of things, of having substance, but are fundamentally without substance, that is, empty. The Buddha is not Buddha. As soon as we use the verb to be, any of its forms, like is, the Buddha is. If we were to say the Buddha is Buddha, then this suggests a substance, a static quality that is not real. All things are just flux. There's no he, no she, no I, no you. These pronouns are very useful in managing our lives and communicating, but they are deceiving. There is no fixed entity anywhere. No self, no other, no Buddha, no sentient beings. So that was the quote from the sutra. And then he says, with realization, there is awareness and great function amid causal origination, penetrating perfectly without obstruction. This is called great cultivation of the path. There is no duality between self and other. All practices are carried out at once. There is no before or after, and no in between. It is called the great vehicle, the Mahayana. He goes on, having no attachments within or without, the great ultimate relinquishment. This is called dana paramita, the perfection of giving. Here in this next paragraph, he addresses the what are called the six paramitas, or the six virtues developed by the bodhisattva, to use the traditional language. It means the virtues we are developing here, now, and in any viable practice. The first is giving. The longer we practice, the more our resistance to giving and giving up erodes. The resistance erodes. The second one is shila, or morality. And he says, good and evil equal, so neither can be found. This is shila paramita, the perfection of morality. The third paramita is kshanti, or forbearance, or patience. To have no transgressions amid the objects of mind, the harm of rancor forever ended, this is kshanti paramita, the perfection of patience. All of these, of course, are extremely advanced states of spiritual enlightenment. Kshanti, or patience, it really means patience in the face of abuse or mistreatment. When we get to Bodhidharma, in just a little while, he'll have more to say about that. The fourth paramita is virya paramita, or effort. Great stillness, unmoving, the myriad activities spontaneously so. This is virya paramita, the perfection of energetic progress. Okay, the fourth paramita is meditation. The flourishing of wondrous stillness. This is dhyana paramita, the perfection of meditation. And then the last, Prajna Paramita. Prajna is wisdom. Wondrous stillness, opening forth illumination. This is Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom. In other schools of Buddhism, prajna is sometimes used to mean knowledge. So you acquire prajna through long study of the sutras and other texts. But as used in Zen, prajna means a transcendental wisdom, that is, seeing beyond knowledge, seeing beyond all forms, the world of form, seeing the formlessness of the world of form, seeing the no-thingness of things. This we call awakening. And then he closes this paragraph by saying, people who are like this are lofty and vast, taking in everything perfectly without obstruction, achieving rich and varied functioning. This is the great vehicle. So there he repeats, this is the Mahayana. These six paramitas are perfections. Even short of the perfection of them, we are developing them. We are cultivating them and developing them through practice. But what he's referring to is the absolute transcendent perfection of these five, these six. He quotes the Huayan Sutra. That's another great Buddhist scripture that is especially, it's the basis of the school of Buddhism, not Zen, but another school of Buddhism called the Huayan or Avatamsaka school. This is a good one. Listen to this. If you have no views, then you can see. Views, and it's Buddhist, in the Buddhist sense of the word, views. It means biases. It implies seeing imperfectly, seeing reality, seeing things through the prism of one's own conditioning, one's own subjective emotional consciousness. In other words, it's the way most people in the world see things. They have views. And then the sutra says, if you have no views, then you can see. The Japanese word kensho, which refers to a first experience of awakening. Kensho, one translation of it is seeing things as they are. When we don't see things as they are, until we see things as they are, our vision is obstructed with views. Views also implies all the knowledge we've acquired, the stuff we've picked up over our lifetime, and that colors our views so that we don't see things as they are in their clarity, simplicity. zazen, is a method for dissolving these, dissolving the prism that prevents us from seeing things as they are. And then he quotes, after that one, if you have no views, then you can see, he quotes another sutra, it is not something seen with the eyes or known by the senses. It must be seen by according with thusness. According with thusness. According with things as they are. This quote continues from this other sutra. All the senses are thus, and so is the thusness of the Dharma. Seeing like this is called correct seeing. Roshi Kaplow always used to say, Zen is beyond the senses, but it is not separate from them. And then he goes right on in the same paragraph, quoting another source. I don't know what it is, the Chan Jue says, bats and owls do not see things in daylight, but rather by night. This is due to the inversions of false thinking. How so? Bats and owls see what to others is darkness as light. Ordinary people see what to others is light as darkness. Both are cases of false thinking. Because of their inverted perceptions, because of their karmic barriers, ordinary people do not see reality. This being so, light is not definitely light and darkness is not definitely darkness. If you understand like this and you are not confused by inverted thinking, then you will enter into the eternity, the bliss, the personality and the purity of the Tathagatas. Let's break this down. Tathagatas is another word for the Buddhas, the enlightened ones. And this cluster of qualities, eternity, bliss, personality, and purity, are the four that we chant in the Kanongyo: eternal, selfless, joyous, pure. Little bit different translation there. Eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. The qualities of nirvana or of perfect enlightenment, which are, of course, are qualities intrinsic to all of us, not something we have to acquire from outside ourselves. He's using, with this bat and owl analogy, he's just using it as a metaphor. He would not say that bats and owls have inverted thinking. He would know, or it, it's a sutra he's quoting. The sutra would surely see bats and owls and as absolutely perfect and whole just as they are, wondrous in their own unique qualities. There's that line in the Hakuin chant that we recite each day. From dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. in that sense, and we're like creatures of the night until we can confirm the lightness, the light of our own nature. Guna Bahadra said, "The Lankavatara Sutra says, how can one purify one's thoughts? Do not allow false thinking. Do not allow defiled thinking. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of Buddha nature. Let mindfulness of Buddha nature continue without a break. You will be still without thoughts, and you will witness the fundamental empty purity." It's quite a mouthful there. Let's just look at one part of it. Purifying one's thoughts can be misleading. It's not that we need to purify them. We just need to see through them. That is a kind of purifying them. Seeing that there's nothing there. There's no substance to our thoughts. They're just thoughts. This is a real turning point in practice when we finally realize that we don't want to have anything to do with our thoughts. That thoughts are thoughts and reality is something else. They're thoughts, and then there's the direct experience of reality. And we need to see the difference in order to refrain from dwelling in our thoughts. That takes a while for most of us. We're so used to involving ourselves in our thoughts. They seem quite real. This is the task of anyone who's new to Zen, is waking up to the fact that thoughts are not our business. They're always going on to one degree or another in the mind, but that's not where we want to be. Where do we want to be? Free of thoughts. They have an endless ability to draw us away from this vivid world of direct experience, these thoughts. They can be so enticing, and we keep getting drawn back into them without even being aware of it when it's happening. Maybe years before we can catch ourselves as the thoughts arise and refrain from getting involved in them. Until then, in those other years, the previous years, we keep discovering that we've been involved in thoughts without knowing it. And then, in the same paragraph, the author here quotes Guna Bahadra again. "Once this is received, you do not fall back from eternal stillness. Thus, the Buddha said, how can it be increased?" How can it be increased? There's nothing lacking in any of us. There is no insufficiency in any of us. He also said, you learn from the teacher, but enlightenment does not come from the teacher. Whoever would, quote, make people wise has never expounded the Dharma. It is verified in the event. Well, this is what I remind people in every new student ceremony, that the teacher can't give you anything that you don't already have. It's not a matter of transmitting something, imparting something. Because nothing needs to be imparted. Every single one of us is whole and complete. We just need to wake up to that. It's not a matter of getting something from a teacher or from anyone else. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.